7th, 2016. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we're coming into the, call it the home stretch on the Majjhima Nikaya. So there are a few more suttas that I skipped over that we'll go back to. Okay, so we're starting today with sutta number 151. This is called the Pindapata Parisuddhi Sutta, which is translated as the purification of alms food. Okay, so the word Pindapata, it's a common word in monastic usage, and it means the food that one receives, usually the food that one receives on alms round. So the word is given a more general sort of application, so that any food that a monk receives is called Pindapata. So even if people bring food to the temple, it's still called, or if they invite the monk to the house and offer food, in a general sense you could also call it Pindapata, the food that he receives. But in the stricter, narrower usage, it's the food that one receives by going on alms round. The word pinda means a lump, referring to especially to the lumps of rice, because people back in the Buddha's day, unlike today where they have like well-prepared, you know, dishes, when the monks would go on alms round, often they would just get like a spoon of food from each house that they would go to. And pata is falling. So it's the lump of food that falls into the alms bowl. And this was an extremely important practice within the early Buddhist tradition, even continuing today in the countries of Southern Asia, in that it, one of its purposes is to establish a sense of community, you could say, a relationship between the monastics and the lay community or the householders, because it shows that when one enters upon the monastic life, one is making oneself completely dependent upon the generosity of the lay supporters. I mean, things have developed and are quite different. Like here at Zhuangyan Monastery, we have a kitchen and a cook and volunteers who come to cook in the kitchen. So I just have to wait each day to hear gong, 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 gong. And then I walk up the hill and there's my food waiting for me. And if it's a rainy day, then I just have to call the kitchen and say, can you please send the food down? And I once thought of going on an alms round around here just to experiment and see what it's like. But, you know, the squirrels just don't have that spirit of generosity. You know, like I think that there is one house across the street, a little to the going in the direction of Carmel, then I think you have to walk miles until you start seeing the next house. But a few years ago, when the other American monk, Kema Ratana, was staying with me, we went into Manhattan intending to go on alms round. And so I had a little sign prepared which said, "I am a Buddhist monk. I collect my food on alms round. I don't accept money. Whatever you have prepared will be accepted with gratitude." And we went down to 3rd Avenue in Manhattan. I went into a few shops and stood there with the sign, but didn't quite work. I think some of the shops that I went to, the thing is that the people who are working in the shops, well, first, they don't have any experience of monks going on alms round. And then the people working in the shop are not the owners of the shop. You know, they're employees. So what are they to make out with? Maybe they see their employer in their mind's eye looking over them and seeing some deficiency in the accounts, some things missing. The only place where somebody spoke to me, I think it was a small Japanese restaurant that I went into, and the woman read the sign, but then she said, "I'm sorry, but this was like 10:30 in the morning," and she said, "We haven't started to prepare the meals for the day yet." So that was my experiment going on alms round. Yeah, I think somebody told me that there's an area in Lower Manhattan. They said Avenue A, Avenue B. I didn't even know there were such avenues in Manhattan, where there's a lot of Cambodian people, Thai people. So maybe I'll try that. Yeah. Excuse me? Yeah, that's... Yeah, I know. Yeah. But you might have just like leftovers from breakfast. Okay, so let us continue, go into the sutta. Okay, so the sutta begins with the Venerable Sariputta comes out from meditation and he comes to the Buddha and pays homage to him and sits down on one side. And then the Buddha says to him that this is a stock passage. He says, "Your faculties are clear. The color of your skin or your complexion is pure and bright. What abiding do you often abide in now?" And so he's referring to, by abiding, he's referring to what kind of meditation have you been practicing? What kind of meditative attainment have you been in? And then Sariputta says, "Now, Venerable Sir, I often abide," here the word is translated as voidness, but this was because this is Venerable Nyanamoli's translation going back to the 1950s, and the terminology for translating Buddha's terms was not yet fixed. But the Pali word is sunyata, and now the alternative rendering has gained dominance, and that is emptiness. And so in Pali, it's sunyata, or sunyata. And of course, this is the same as the better known Sanskrit, shunyata, which forms the theme of the Prajnaparamita Sutras. And in the Pali literature, unlike in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the word sunyata doesn't occur very often. But here it seems to be given special significance, particularly as when Sariputta says that he often abides in sunyata, then the Buddha applauds him and he says, sadhu, sadhu, Sariputta. Excellent, excellent, Sariputta. Now you often abide in the abiding of a great man, a Mahapurisa. For this is the abiding of a great man, namely sunyata, or emptiness. Now, I've been thinking about how the words sunya and sunyata are used in the text of early Buddhism, and I come up with maybe four ways in which it's used. Not that they're completely separable, but just in an abstract way, we might disentangle their entangled meanings. One is what I would call a psychological sense, and that is a sense in which the mind in certain meditative states is said to be empty of greed, empty of hatred, empty of delusion. We find this use in a sutta, let's see, this is sutta number 43 on page 395. For example, in paragraph 35, at the end it said, now that unshakable deliverance of mind is void or empty of lust, empty of hate, empty of delusion. Okay, so this is what I call the psychological dimension of emptiness. That is, a mind which is empty of defiled mental qualities, mental states. Okay, a second aspect of emptiness, this is what I would call, I have to use a big frightening word, ontological meaning of emptiness. Ontology is the philosophy concerned with the nature of existence, the nature of being. And in this sense, emptiness means that all phenomena are empty of a self or of anything belonging to a self, or that phenomena are empty of any kind of substantial nature, substantial identity. We see this meaning of emptiness also in sutta number 43. This is on page 394 in paragraph 33. Here, I think it's Sariputta who's speaking, who's explaining the deliverance of mind through voidness, or liberation of mind through emptiness. And here, the monk, gone to the forest, the foot of the tree, reflects, this is void, or this is empty of a self, or of what belongs to a self. This would be referring to any phenomena that are being contemplated. Could be the five aggregates, it's 6, 12 sense bases, And in fact, this leads into another sutta that illustrates this meaning of emptiness. This is Saṅyutta Nikāya, chapter 35. I believe it's sutta number 85 or 88, something in that area. This is where Ananda comes to the Buddha and says that there is this expression, the world is empty, the world is empty. In what sense is the world empty? And then the Buddha says, it is empty in the sense that it is empty of a self or of anything belonging to a self. And then the Buddha goes on to explain, what is it that is empty of a self or of what belongs to a self? The eye is empty, the ear is empty, the nose is empty, the tongue is empty, the body is empty, the mind is empty. All is empty of a self or of what belongs to a self. Boy, it sounds even a little bit like the Heart Sutra. It's starting to sound like the Heart Sutra. Okay, so that's the ontological aspect of emptiness. And then a third aspect of emptiness, again, I use a big word, frightening word. Maybe you can call this the phenomenological aspect of emptiness. This is phenomenology, is the philosophy concerned with the way things appear within experience. And so this aspect is concerned, you could say, concerned with the way, what I would call particular ways of directing the attention in a meditative state. And we find the illustration of this in sutta number 121. This is called, in fact, the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the shorter discourse on voidness. And so here, in a sequence, the Buddha is explaining to the monks how to direct the attention in successively more refined ways by bringing to mind what is missing or empty in a particular experience. We went through this sutta some time ago. Let me just take some examples. Okay, we just take the first passage in which this phenomenological approach is presented. This is page 965, paragraph 4. Okay, here the Buddha says, just as this palace of Migara's mother is void or empty of elephants, cattle, horses, and mares, and so on, and there is present only this non-voidness, namely the singleness dependent on the Sangha of bhikkhus, so too a bhikkhu, not attending to the perception of village, not attending to the perception of people, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of forest. And then jumping down a few sentences to the end, the bottom of the page, he understands this field of perception is empty of the perception of village. This field of perception is empty of the perception of people. And so here one is taking the field of perception and focusing upon what is not present there, and that will give like one level of a perception of emptiness. And then one carries that process through successively more refined meditative states till one comes to the very high and exalted states of samadhi. Until we come to something like this, field of perception is void of the perception of the base of nothingness, void of the perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. There is present only this non-voidness or non-emptiness that is that connected with the six sense bases that are dependent on this body and conditioned by life. Okay, so this is what I call a phenomenological aspect of emptiness. And then there is a particular, yeah, that would be useful, particular meditative state. We actually find a series or a set of three very high meditative states which seem to be like almost marking the threshold to the realization of Nibbana. So these three meditative states are called the Animitta Samadhi, the Animitta Samadhi, that is the samadhi, maybe we translate it as the signless or markless concentration. That is, well, actually there are different explanations. Let me just go through all three of them. The Upanihita Samadhi, this is Upanihita, you could say, is the desireless or wishless concentration. And then the Sunyata Samadhi, this is the emptiness concentration. And these are taken to be three different aspects or approaches to the attainment of Nibbana. And each one is sort of contemplating Nibbana in terms of three qualities of Nibbana. So Nibbana itself is animitta, markless or signless, because it doesn't have any of the marks or signs of conditioned phenomena. And then Nibbana is wishless or desireless, because in Nibbana, there's no craving. And then Nibbana is emptiness, because it's void of lust, hatred, and delusion. And also Nibbana is void of any self or anything belonging to a self. And so the samadhi, which is focusing upon Nibbana under these three aspects, is called either the signless concentration, the desireless, wishless concentration, and or the sunyata samadhi, the emptiness concentration. Okay, so what is the abiding in voidness, abiding in emptiness that Sariputta has been dwelling in? Okay, according, the sutta itself doesn't explain. It just says the Buddha just congratulates or applauds Sariputta and says, excellent, excellent. That is the dwelling of the Mahapurusha, the great men. But what is this abiding in emptiness? According to the commentary, what the commentary says is that this is called the Arahata Pala Samapatti, which means the, what can be translated, the meditative attainment of the fruit of arahatship. Okay, now each, the attainment of each of the four stages of awakening or enlightenment involves two aspects. One is called the path. The path is what I describe as the momentary breakthrough experience, where the mind emerges from all conditioned phenomena and just for a moment realizes or penetrates to the unconditioned. And with the attainment of that path experience, the mind breaks certain fetters or cuts off certain defilements. Just in one moment, it just breaks off those defilements. And then that is followed by an experience called the fruit of the path. And that fruit experience just lasts a few moments, in which one experiences the bliss of Nibbana, that bliss of freedom, just for a few moments before the mind returns to the level of ordinary consciousness. And one goes through these stages four times, you know, it could be in the course of one life, over several lives, in order to reach the final goal. And then the final attainment is the path of arahatship, which cuts off the remaining subtle defilements, and it issues in the fruit of arahatship, that is, that blissful experience of nibbanic liberation. Okay, now, after one achieves arahatship, one doesn't have to go through the path again. Once one goes through the path of arahatship, there's nothing further to be done in terms of eradicating any more defilements. But the arahat has permanent access to the fruition attainment. That is, when he wants, he can sit down and make the determination, the resolve to enter the fruition, and then he'll enter into that meditative experience, which is the fruit of arahatship. And in that meditative experience, he'll be, through the duration, he or she will be experiencing Nibbana, you know, directly, without any obstacles, anything in between the meditator and Nibbana. And so if one wants to experience the Nibbanic bliss for a half an hour, one sits and one goes into the fruition for a half an hour. If one wants to sit for an hour, one makes that determination and one will experience Nibbanic bliss for an hour. If one wants to sit for 3 hours, 5 hours, one will persist in that state. And so apparently, Sariputta had been abiding in that fruit of arahatship all day long. Okay, and that fruit of arahatship, in this case, is being called the abiding in emptiness, because in Sariputta's experience of, you see, one can experience the fruition of arahatship in any of these three modalities, depending upon which aspect of Nibbana one focuses upon. If one wants to focus upon Nibbana as lacking the marks of condition, as free from the marks of conditioned phenomena, then one will enter into fruition experience through Nibbana as the markless or signless. If one wants to focus on Nibbana as the absence of desire, then one enters into the desireless liberation. And if one focuses upon Nibbana as empty or void of self or anything belonging to a self, then one enters into the emptiness fruition experience. Okay, so this is apparently what the Buddha is applauding when he says that this is the abiding of a great man, namely emptiness. Maybe I'll ask if there's any questions at this point.
Is there a fruit of abiding in Nibbana beyond simply enjoying it? Simply experiencing the bliss of it?
I don't quite...
Well, like where I'm at in my meditation now, it's sort of a process of striving.
Yeah.
Once one has attained Nibbana...
Yeah.
Why does one meditate? Why does one spend time in Nibbana? I mean,
I see.
It's kind of an odd question.
I understand the question. I think because it's a blissful and peaceful experience, and one is free from all of the disturbances that come from, you know, the impingement of sense objects.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, because that is like the final goal of this spiritual life is to enter into what's called the Nibbana element without residue remaining. That is the Nibbana with the passing away of the liberated one, the state of complete and ultimate freedom. But as long as one has the life and the body, of course, then one can't enter into that. But this is like the closest that is possible while still within embodied existence.
Okay. Thank you, Bhante.
Okay, Stephen.
Bhante, I have a question. If one is able to sort of apprehend sunyata, maybe in the ontological sense, and would that be sunyata cheto vimuti? And does that relate directly to an attainment? Or is that, I mean, when one is capable of that, does that relate to some sort of fetter dropping away?
The sunyata cheto vimuti explained in sutta number 43?
Yeah, the ability to see sunyata. Really see.
In the sense of things being empty of a self or what belongs to self, that is part of what I would call the higher stages of insight. It doesn't necessarily entail that one has reached an attainment, but it is the path of insight that will lead to an attainment. Though somebody who's already reached an attainment can go back and cultivate that insight into emptiness, the emptiness of self or what belongs to self. But the fact that somebody is cultivating that contemplation of emptiness of self doesn't mean that they've actually reached an attainment. Okay, if there's no... Yes.
But the difference between the first one, the animitta and what shunyata concentration...
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem to be like very close?
Well, I can't just speak from personal experience. for us it seems like, because these states seem very abstract, so they seem very similar. But I guess that there is subtle difference between them, depending upon the aspect that's being stressed or that's being focused on. So it's said that the animitta samadhi comes from focusing upon the absence of the marks or signs of conditioned phenomena. And it's, in the Visuddhimagga system, it's related to the contemplation of impermanence, that somebody who makes sort of the basis of their insight practice the characteristic of impermanence will tend towards the animitta samadhi. Because what's meant by animitta, especially, it said, is the absence of the mark of permanence. And then it said that the sunyata samadhi comes to those who make their emphasis, their point of focus, the non-self aspect of conditioned phenomena, that all phenomena are devoid of self or anything belonging to self. Yeah, so they seem very similar, from a distance, but I guess as one gets close up, one could see subtle differences between them. Okay, let us go on now into the text of the sutta. So now the Buddha is going to explain to Sariputta, for the sake of others, since he's speaking to Sariputta, he's going to explain how to often abide in voidness, to abide in emptiness. And he does this in a very practical way. And this relates to how the monk should reflect while on the alms round. Okay, so he says that if a monk should wish, may I now often abide in emptiness, he should consider thus, on the path by which I went to the village for alms, or in the place where I wandered for alms, or on the path by which I returned from the alms round, was there any desire, lust, hate, delusion, or aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye? And what strikes me when I just read that sentence is that it's very attentive to the details of going on the alms round. And unless one has gone on the alms round, it may be a little difficult to appreciate this, but we actually divide it into three stages. There's the stage where one is walking from one's monastery or dwelling place to the village or town where one is going to walk for alms. Okay, then there's the group of houses amongst which one is walking for alms. And then there is the walk back from the village to one's residence. So you could see in the sentence that alms round is divided into these three sectors. And then we have six mental defilements are mentioned, but actually they're really reducible to three, because in two instances, two terms are used which are virtually synonyms. That is, desire and lust are the same, virtually the same, and then hatred and aversion are virtually the same. I don't know why the text uses six rather than the usual three. Sometimes it could just be that, you know, reciters, when they have a transmitted text, sometimes will add words as a way of commenting on the term. And then the word that's added as a commentary or a definition gets absorbed into the text itself. Okay, and this sort of advice that the Buddha gives is very important for one going an alms round, because, well, one has to be very frank, okay, when one is living in the temple all day long, or especially a meditating monk living in a little hut, maybe high on a hill or in the forest, there's not very much to excite the senses. And, you know, it's just looking out, trees, and maybe some monkeys or squirrels playing around. You look inside, there's nothing but a bed, a desk, a sitting mat, and nothing else. And the mind naturally seeks enjoyment through the senses. And in the case of a monk living in a monastery, especially a younger monk, what one likes to see are females. And on the alms round, those who are offering the food, usually the men, this is in an agrarian society, during the day the men are out in the field, working in the field, or in the town, working in the shops. But at home, those who are preparing the food, are going to offer the food, will be the women. And in the family, for a young monk, there might be some nice young, you know, young girls, 16, 17 years old, who will come out and offer the food. And so the one is taught that one should keep the eyes downcast, but there'll be a peeking up. And I know from personal experience, when one is just training to keep the eyes downcast and looking at the feet and just getting a vague impression of the young woman who's offering the alms, the mind will be fashioning images of, like, who are the beauties today? I mean, back in my day, it was like, well, past Marilyn Monroe, but I think past Bridget Bardot. I don't even remember in those days. But today, maybe, is Taylor Swift considered a... No? What? But the mind... Okay, the mind will be just fashioning these imaginary projections onto the face. Until one looks up, sometimes there comes a big disappointment. But as long as the eye is focused on the feet and the hands. And then sometimes they will say, "How are you today, Bhante?" And that gives an excuse for looking up. But when it's time to recite the blessing, one looks up. Okay, so the eye is sort of moving towards sights, forms that are delightful to the eye. And then, so this is the opportunity for, what do they say here in the text? Desire and lust. And then there are occasions when one is approaching the house. Of course, one gets the smell of delicious food. That's another kind of desire and lust, and when they're offering the food and one sees the food being put into the bowl, of course, ideally one is supposed to be indifferent whether one gets good food or bad food, but when you see that they've made some really nice preparation and you get the delicious smell, then desire, craving starts to arise. But then there are other occasions when it's approaching the house, when getting closer and closer, and then one hears the grrr, grrr, ruff, ruff, ruff. I mean, big, deep, loud barking. And the smell is delicious, and you know the people are expecting you, but that dog is standing there, chained to a pole, but tearing at the pole as though it's going to break loose and start coming after you. And then there comes anger, aversion, frustration, fear. And then sometimes one will come to the house. I mean, this doesn't... this won't happen not very often in the traditional Buddhist country like Sri Lanka, certainly not in Burma or Thailand. But in India, there were, you know, people were not all followers of Buddhism or even respectful towards ascetics. And so if one comes to the house, and people sometimes will say, like, get away, we don't want you around here. And in that case, if one is not well trained in mind, then there arises anger, aversion, ill will. Well, if the people say, you know, get away, we don't want you, then one has to, you know, move on. Well, what I've, in the past, what I would do is stand there, and then when the people hear the dog barking, they come out, and since they want to offer alms to the monk, then they'll tell the dog, you know, quiet, quiet, or they'll bring the dog into the house. Yeah, I think I would do that. Yeah, just for a couple of minutes. Yeah, because there's a story that comes down. Actually, it comes down. I think it's in the Melinda Panha, the Questions of King Melinda, where the monk Nagasena. He knew. No, this was. Let me just get my. No, this was the boy who was to become Nagasena, but the Sangha knew that this boy had descended from the heavenly world in order to become Nagasena, to become a great monk, in order to fulfill, you know, certain responsibilities in maintaining the Dharma. But he was born into a Brahmin family, and the Brahmins had a somewhat antagonistic attitude towards Buddhism. But the elder monk would go every day to the Brahmin's house in order to try to make a connection, to get a foot in the door, to make a contact with this boy who was to become Nagasena. And every day when the Brahmin sees the monk, he doesn't pay any attention to him. So the monk just stands there for a few minutes, no response. And then since there's no response, he has to move on to the other houses. Then one day, the monk is standing there in front of the house, and then the first time, the Brahmin comes out from the house and says, "Move on, venerable sir. We don't give to Buddhist monks." And then the elder monk says, "Thank you very much." And then the Brahmin is puzzled by this and thinks, "I didn't give him anything. I told him to move on, and yet he thanks me. Why is that?" And then he thinks, there must be something special about these Buddhist monks. So then he calls him into the house and says, "Why is it that I didn't give you anything, but you thanked me?" And then the monk says, well, I've been coming to your house for alms, what, for a year or so? And previously, you never even had the courtesy to come out to say a word to me. You just remained in the house silently. But now you came and you asked me to move on. So I thanked you for at least speaking a few words to me. And then with this, the Brahmin's mind was changed. And then he said, wait a few moments. And he told his wife, get some food ready, and prepared it, offered it, and then invited the elder monk to come in the future, you know, to come call regularly for alms. And that way the elder monk was able to get to know this boy, who then decided he wanted to become a monk, and then he became the great monk Nagasena. Okay, so let us continue. Okay, so the monk should consider whether there were any of these defilements in his mind. Okay, so then reviewing his own mind, if he knows on the path by which I went to the village for alms, or in the place where I wandered for alms, or on the path by which I returned from the alms round, there was desire, lust, hate, delusion, aversion in my mind regarding forms cognizable by the eye, then he should make an effort to abandon those evil, I think that's too strong a word, I'll call them just bad, unwholesome states. But if by reviewing he knows that there was no desire, lust, hate, and so on, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. Okay, so this shows a monk who's still in the stage of training. Obviously, this is not an arahat, but But this is a training of the mind in order to purify the mind, I would say, in order to prepare it, maybe in the long run, for the attainment that will result in the fruit of arhatship. Okay, and then the same thing is repeated for each of the other sense modalities. So with regard to sounds, regard to odors, regard to tastes, which one is unlikely to obtain taste unless people on the alms rounds invite you to sit. Sometimes they do this, actually. They invite one to sit down, and then apart from offering the regular food, they'll say, would you like a cup of tea? And then they'll prepare some tea, or sometimes a cup of what they call kanji. You know, it's the rice porridge. And the rice porridge is rather bland tasting, but there's something called kola kenda, which is flavored with greens, green herbs, and it's very tasty. And tangibles cognizable by the body, and mind objects cognizable by the mind, those would be any kind of like thoughts or mental images that come into the mind independent of the senses. So again, one reviews one's own mind in the same way. Okay, so that takes us through the six sense modalities. And I read Bhikkhu Anālayo has a comparison of this Pali version of the sutta with its parallel as a parallel in the Saṅyuktāgama. It's actually the parallel or the counterpart to the Pali Saṅyutta Nikāya. And this is the parallel preserved in Chinese translation. And that version ends here. And this suggests, and this is a point that Venerable Anālayo makes, that it could be that the more archaic form of the sutta ended here, and that the later sections were added, you know, by the reciters in order to create a fuller sutta. But anyway, I like the fuller version because it seems to add what I would call systematic elements. And so we can see a scheme emerging in these additional sections. Okay, so now the Buddha says, you see, these sections up through paragraph 8, those are all really concerned with the alms round. And so those fit the title of the sutta. But these additional sections are no longer concerned with the alms round, but with other aspects of training. Okay, so now in section 9 we have that the monk should consider thus are the five cords of sensual pleasure abandoned by me. Okay, if by reviewing he knows that the five cords of sensual pleasure are not abandoned, then he should make an effort to abandon them. And if by reviewing he knows that the five cords or objects of sensual pleasure are abandoned, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. Okay, then I want to take these two sections together. The next section, the monk should consider thus, are the five hindrances abandoned by me? And then the same process is applied to the five hindrances. If they're not abandoned, one should make the effort to abandon them. If they are abandoned, then one could abide happy and glad, training in wholesome states. Okay, now it seems to me that these two sections are concerned with the development of samadhi, particularly the jhanas. And the reason why I say this is because if we take the formula for the first jhana, for example, we find it Sutta 27, okay, yeah. Somebody said page 69? Yeah, but it's the passage that I have in mind is, we could say that it starts on page 274 at the bottom, paragraph 18, which speaks about the abandoning of the five hindrances. And then it goes in paragraph 19, having thus abandoned those five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and abides in the first jhana. And so here we have in Sutta 151, we have the abandoning or giving up of the five strands or cords or objects of sensual pleasure. So this would imply sort of detaching oneself from involvement in the objects of sensual pleasure. And then paragraph 10 takes us to a deeper level where one is cleansing the mind of the five hindrances: sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and regret, and doubt. Okay, so this is clearing the way to the attainment of the deeper stages of samadhi or the jhanas. Okay, then the next section, this is paragraph 11, says, are the five aggregates subject to clinging fully understood by me? And the full understanding of the five aggregates, that takes place, the way I understand the term, that takes place with the attainment of arhatship. But in order to reach the full understanding of the five aggregates, one has to begin with insight meditation. And so that means one has to see into the impermanence, the unsatisfactory nature, the selfless nature of the five aggregates. And so even if one knows that the five aggregates have not been fully understood, that means that one is not an arhat. One still has to begin, you know, walking that path to full understanding by developing the insight into the five aggregates. Okay, then we could see the next sections. We have the text brings in the 37 aids to enlightenment, the seven groups of enlightenment factors, that is the four foundations of mindfulness, the four kinds of striving or right effort, the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven enlightenment factors, and the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, the way I might see this, this is sort of my own interpretation. Even though full understanding of the five aggregates is the accomplishment of the arhat, but we could say that the first breakthrough of penetrative wisdom that sees the real nature of the five aggregates, that takes place with the attainment of stream entry. So the stream enterer has developed insight up to the point of seeing the ultimate truth of the Dhamma, and with the penetration of that ultimate truth, the five aggregates appear in their real nature as being impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self. Okay, now to move from the stage of stream enterer to the stage of arhat, one has to develop the 37 aids to enlightenment. So we could see those sections are brought in here in order to show the transitional process moving from stream enterer to the verge of arhatship. Okay, then to bring the attainment of arhatship, we could see the next section comes in. That is serenity and insight, samatha and vipassana. Of course, samatha and vipassana, serenity and insight, have to be developed throughout this whole process of cultivation. But we could say that they're brought in here because at this point, they have to be brought into balance and brought to a certain pitch of perfection. Okay, and then when they're brought into balance and brought to that degree of strength, then there comes the breakthrough to the attainment of arhatship, the final fruit. And then the final fruit of arhatship is marked by bringing together two other qualities, which are called vijja, or clear knowledge, and vimukti, liberation. So that takes us to paragraph 20. So the monk should consider thus our true knowledge and deliverance realized by me. And notice here, this is something to be realized. The others are things to be developed. The different aids to enlightenment are to be developed. But true knowledge and deliverance, or clear knowledge and liberation, these are things to be realized. So these terms indicate the fruit of arhatship. Okay, so if he knows by reviewing that he has not realized them, then he should make the effort to realize them. But if by reviewing he knows that he has realized them, then it said he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. Actually, if he's realized true knowledge and deliverance, then there's no further need for training. But I think that expression is repeated here just in a mechanical way, just because it's a certain refrain that's being repeated for each section. Okay, and then apparently by achieving this true knowledge and liberation, though no further mention has been made in the rest of the sutta about the abiding in emptiness, but by realizing this clear knowledge and liberation, then one is able to abide in emptiness. Okay, then the Buddha concludes the sutta with an important statement, which I think it's intended to emphasize the value of this mode of practice. He says, whatever... Suddenly I'm getting this phlegm in the throat, I don't know. Really? Other people are getting them from the flower? I'll survive. Okay, what? But I don't know that I'll complete this sutta. I'll survive. Whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the past have purified their alms food, have all done so by repeatedly reviewing thus. Whatever ascetics and Brahmins in the future will purify their alms food, will all do so by repeatedly reviewing thus. Whatever ascetics and Brahmins at present are purifying their alms food, are all doing so by repeatedly reviewing thus. Therefore, Sariputta, you should train thus. We will purify our alms food by repeatedly reviewing thus. Actually, Sariputta is already, presumably at this point, an arahat, so he doesn't actually have to train. But probably the Buddha is saying this, so he's speaking to Sariputta. He has in mind not Sariputta himself, but the other monks and later generations of monks. Okay, that takes us to the end of the sutta. And if there's any questions, please feel welcome to ask the questions. And the reason why I'm laughing, I'm turning out to be very, my word is turning out to be very unreliable. Each week I send out the notice through the monastery. This week we'll be taking two suttas. And then it turns out that I take up almost the whole class with one sutta and not enough time to take the second sutta. Wait, you take the microphone.
The five chords of sensual pleasure.
Yeah.
They talk about the five hindrances. I know what they are. But the five chords of sensual pleasure, the term chords, what exactly is that?
Yeah, it's the Pali word. The Pali word is kama guna. Yeah, kama is sensual desire or sensual pleasure. Then guna, the word guna is used in many senses. Here, the way it's explained or defined in the suttas, don't take the English word chord too literally. I don't know why I think Nyanamoli used the word chord. Yeah, I don't know why he used that. But it said there are some suttas that define kama guna. Let's see, sutta number 13. We get the definition of 13. Yeah. Those are the forms cognizable by the eye, which are... Okay, page 180. Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. Excuse me? It's not the five sense organs themselves, it's the five objects of the sense faculties. And so one can't actually, I'd have to say one can't abandon, literally abandon the five enjoyable objects of the senses, because they are there whether you want them to be there or not. I mean, when that young monk is going on his arms round, the beautiful girl is going to come out with the delicious food, and so he's not going to run away, but it's... and speaking to him with the sweet voice, "How are you today, Venerable?" But basically, I think what is meant is that controlling the tendency of the mind to run out to the enjoyable objects of the senses and then to become fixated upon them. Yeah, that is if one picks up on the English word chord. But the Pali word guna is more like quality. So we could say the sensual qualities, but it's referring basically to pleasant objects of the five senses.
Bhante, earlier you talked about, or you read something about non-voidness.
About?
Non-voidness. And something single, a singleness. Did I hear that right? And I wondered if that was related to duality and non-duality.
Non-voidness. Yeah. Oh, I see, non-voidness. I was just reading a passage from that sutta, and it's not speaking about non-duality in any philosophical sense, but rather these are modes of training the mind in order to modes of training the mind in order to elevate it to higher and more refined levels of consciousness by, in stages, excluding the grosser or coarser object and then just focusing the mind one-pointedly upon the subtler object. But I was just quoting that passage from an earlier sutta that we examined just to bring out a particular way in which the word sunyata or emptiness is used in the text.
Thank you, Bhante.
Okay, any further questions? Yeah, please. What is your name, Bhante? Your name?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. My name's Ian.
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 Yes.
Ian, yeah.
Hi. I trust you're sure that once one attains arahantship, there is no further training to be done. Because that's kind of what I was asking with my question earlier.
Yeah.
Whether there is further training to be done, whether it's something you kind of have to practice and maintain. And the fact that it recurs here those couple of times, true knowledge and deliverance are realized by me, he can abide happy and glad, training day and night, and thus you should train, Sariputta.
Yeah, I think that, again, that this is just what I would call a mechanical repetition of a formula. Because the arhat, you see, those who are on the lower stages of the path are called seka, which means one in training, or a trainee. And then another term for the arahat is useka, which means one who is not a trainee. But I translate useka, one beyond training, or one who has completed the training. Because somebody like me, I'm an useka in the sense of lazy, negligent.
Thank you, Bhante.
Any further questions? So shall we try to take one sutta 152 in 5 minutes?
Is it a really short sutta?
It's short, it's a little complicated, so. No, I don't think I could do it in 5 minutes. No further questions. Oh, good.
The question is, what are the four contexts of emptiness again? Psychological, ontological, phenomenal, and the fourth one is?
Okay. What I call psychological, and that is referring to the aspect of the mind being empty or void of lust, hatred, and delusion. The ontological refers to the contemplation of things as being empty of a self or anything belonging to a self. And that's the ontological. Then what I call the phenomenological, that is the kind illustrated in Sutta 121, the shorter discourse on emptiness. And that is the the direction of the mind in such a way, I don't remember if I found a very succinct way to explain that. Okay, that's the meaning of phenomenology. Okay, but this is, okay, the direction of attention in such a way that one excludes from it or empties the mind of successively coarser objects of experience in order to focus it on successively subtler objects of experience. And then the fourth context is this context of the three kinds of samadhi, which I call the meditative context, where we have the signless or markless concentration, the wishless, desireless concentration, and the emptiness concentration. And I thought of another passage which illustrates the ontological aspect of emptiness, though it doesn't use the word empty itself, but this occurs, this is Saṅyutta Nikāya, chapter 22, sutta number 95. In this sutta, the Buddha and the monks, they're dwelling on the banks of the river Ganges, and then a lump of foam comes flowing down the river, and then the Buddha points to the lump of foam and he says that you look at this lump of foam, it looks, when you look at it from a distance, it looks solid and substantial, but when you examine it closely, you see that it is hollow, void, you could say empty, though the text doesn't use the word sunya. And then he says, in the same way, material form or rupa appears to be solid and substantial, but when you examine it with wisdom, it's hollow and empty. And then he says, feeling in the same way, it's like bubbles, water bubbles on the surface of water. They look solid and substantial, but they just break up and vanish. In the same way, feeling breaks up and vanishes. And then a mirage that appears on the horizon appears real, substantial, like the mirage of water when you're driving down the road on a sunny day. But when you pass that mirage, there's nothing there. And that is like perception. And then the trunk of a banana tree appears to be solid and substantial, but when you cut it down and look for the hardwood inside, there's nothing. It's just rolls upon rolls upon rolls. And that is like the mental formations, the sankharas. And then the illusion created by a magician, the illusion of, apparently the Indian magicians were able to create illusions of elephants and horses and palaces. But when you examine them closely, you find that there's nothing there. And that is like consciousness. Okay, Edwin had a question.
Well, now that you bring that up quickly, in science they explain that when you hit the floor, you're actually hitting, you know, nothing. You're actually hitting space because it's all atoms. So yeah, it's all actually just energy. But my question was, it's note 1351. Although the arahant who has realized true knowledge and deliverance has no need for further training. But then again, he goes on to say he continues to cultivate serenity, insight in order to enter into the bliss of the jhanas,
yeah,
the fruition,
yeah,
attainment of the arahantship and cessation of perception and feeling.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I've seen it a little contradicting, unless I'm misunderstanding it. That if he gets true knowledge and deliverance has no need for further training, then why is he still training further? It doesn't, I mean, he continues to cultivate serenity, so where is his training stop, and wait, where does
wait,
it begin?
There's a little competition taking
place.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. anticipation.
Speak loudly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. But then again, he states that there's no need for further training.
Yeah.
So where he stopped, and then when does he begins again, he states that he continues to cultivate serenity.
Yeah.
And insight.
Yeah.
I'm sure that he stopped somewhere to somewhere else, of course. But it seems contradicting to me. I mean,
it's not really contradictory. Training, the word training suggests that there's still a goal that one hasn't yet attained, and one is practicing to realize that goal. Now, in the case of the arhat, he's already achieved the final goal. So there's nothing further to achieve.
At his level, he stopped at that level already. He achieved that training.
But he...
Then he continues into insight. Okay.
But there's still that... those attainments that he has access to. He doesn't have to train to realize them.
I get it.
As something that he hasn't yet achieved. But in order to enter into them, he has to undertake these practices.
Okay, thanks.
But it's not for the purpose of eradicating any more defilements or achieving some higher stage beyond his arhatship.
Thanks, Bhante. Thanks.
Bhante, isn't it a mind moment when you become the arahant? And that once you attain that mind moment, then that's it.
The path of arahatship, according to the Abhidhamma system, is just a mind moment. That mind moment is what eradicates the fetters. But then after that, there comes, you know, the fruition experience. Then one emerges as an arahat.
Thank you.
But and one continues through the rest of one's life to be an arhat. It's not that one is an arhat for one mind moment.
Exactly. Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah. Okay, we'll end now and we'll come back at, say, 12:20 in order for 12:15, 12:20 to have a little further discussion. I really feel like a promise breaker, you know? But next week, we'll take Sutta 152. Even though it doesn't take that much time, we'll see. Maybe there are interesting things we could find in it. Like this sutta, I thought would take like about 20 minutes. And I have that. Those will probably take two sessions each, Sutta number 1 and Sutta number 140, number 43. Oh, I see. Yeah, that doesn't take so much attention, but maybe if we have a little time next week, we'll take a look at it. Okay, so let us share the merits. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasa ta chabuma ta Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya avichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin.